Hello, good afternoon. You're listening to The Country Hour. My name's Bridget Fitzgerald. It's great to be with you on this Monday. All week this week, we're going to take a look at a few examples of diversification on the farm. Have you diversified into something a little bit different? Taken a different road? You can let us know on 0448 922 604. Did it work out for you? Are you still just finding your way? Or did you decide to leave it altogether? 0448 922 604. I want to hear from you. Your examples of diversification on the farm. Coming up after 12:30 today, we'll hear our first example, and we'll hear stories all through the week of farmers right around the state doing something a little bit different. See how it's working out for them. That coming up for you after 12:30 today. But first, Port Hedland was buzzing over the weekend, with cattle being loaded onto a live export ship for the first time in years. About 2,000 head of Pilbara cattle were loaded onto the Angus Express, which took off for Indonesia on Saturday night. Amid the people, the trucks and the cattle, Michelle Stanley was there to check it all out.
It's been a few years since we heard these sounds coming out of the port of Port Hedland. Almost 4 years, in fact. But on Saturday, the cattle were well and truly back.
Yeah, look, there's a buzz around the place, a lot of excitement through the port, and as we see around town, I think a reinvigoration of the trade through Port Hedland is good to see, a bit of diversification of cargoes. Very popular spot down here at the moment, lots of people wanting to come and have a look.
Pilbara Ports Authority's John Giles wasn't alone in his excitement. The few pastoralists whose cattle made up the 2,000 head which boarded the Angus Express on Saturday were also stoked. Pilbara cattle producers are estimating thousands of dollars in savings. For Munda Station near Port Hedland, the rough estimate was they'd be about 30 cents per kilo better off having the option to ship out of Port Hedland instead of trucking their cattle down to properties and sale yards just north of Perth. And that doesn't even include the price difference, which for some lines was an 80 cent premium from the most recent sale at Mushay. And alongside the cost benefits for pastoralists, Port Hedland Export Depot owner Paul Brown says it's also a positive for the cattle.
You know, you don't lose as much in weight, you don't have to pay as much in transport, but the cattle end up better. And a credit to the pastoralists that have put cattle in our yards, the cattle have come in just outstanding quality.
The Port Hedland Export Depot hasn't seen a single head of cattle come through in 4 years. So that's 4 years with rent, registrations and licences to pay, and no income. Paul Brown has put that at an annual cost of up to $40,000.
We've kept a good faith contract, or what we believe is a good faith contract with the Pilbara cattle industry, by making sure that we kept our acres registration, our weighbridge certifications, and having the machinery and the yards in good condition, because we were always confident that it would start, but we didn't know when. So similarly with this one, it was very short notice. We were able to put things together pretty quickly. It has been expensive, you know, rates and leases and, like I said, registrations and certifications, but that's part of the cattle industry. And we wanted to make sure that when it was restarted, that at very short notice, we were able to do that for the Pilbara cattle industry.
As Paul Brown says, that money has been spent, and he's now looking towards the future. Back at the port, John Giles was pleased to see diversification coming through the port again.
Oh, look, I think it's really good. A good news story, I think, for the Pilbara itself and a little bit wider afield, that we can get livestock continuing to come through the port here. So it's probably the news story, I guess, is for pastoralists and the industry itself here through. And the port's just happy that we've been able to invest in some infrastructure to complement what we already have and to, I guess, to be geared up for more shipments and larger shipments if required.
With two camp drafts and a rodeo around the Pilbara while they were looking to find cattle for the ship, it made it tricky. But there are hopes from right around the region that it won't be the last.
Look, we're ready and willing whenever that ship may be. As I said, we've always been open for business for the livestock trade through here. We are aware that we're towards the end of the season now for the northwest. But we're happy to accommodate any more that shall come. So I guess we'll be talking with industry specifically in other forums after this and encouraging them to use us if there's any opportunity this season, but certainly for next season to be geared up for some more regular shipments.
And that's really where the focus is for next year, to say, well, we turn off 100,000+ cattle out of the Pilbara, let's take a big chunk of those into 2018 for exports to our markets.
But for Landmark agent Leon Goad, it'll be up to the Ducks.
The Pilbara shipping is going to be a fairly opportunistic shipping port. If the cattle are there and the shipping works and the cattle are fit for the customer's requirements, and definitely. So I think all the Ducks need to line up, which they did on this one, and hopefully we can piece together another.
Landmark livestock agent Leon Goad ending that report from Michelle Stanley. And today is the last day of the Muslim festival of sacrifice, Eid al-Adha, which is marked by the slaughtering of animals and donating of meat to the poor. For Muslims in poor countries, it's often the only time of year they'll eat meat. On Friday, we heard from the Australian Live Exporters Council about how significant the festival is for livestock exporters, as well as some of the problems that inevitably arise for animal welfare at the busy time of year. But as Jess Davis reports, it's also a time when abattoirs and butchers here in Australia play a key role in donating meat for the celebration.
At the Horsham Sale Yards in Western Victoria, Greg Nichols is buying sheep for the nearby stall abattoir. They'll be slaughtered for the Muslim festival of sacrifice, Eid al-Adha.
The stock that we're going to kill will be bought and purchased by rich Muslims, basically, I think, and they give them to the poor. So, yeah, it's Robin Hood sort of thing.
There's huge demand. Almost 5,000 sheep were killed at stall abattoir over just 3 days last week. Most of the meat is exported to the Middle East, and Greg Nichols says other orders are put on hold to allow the special Eid orders to be done.
There's no great fortune in it. In honesty, we probably do more of a service rather than an idea of making money.
As well as exporting meat, abattoirs also complete special orders from local halal butchers. At Medina Halal Meats in Melbourne, staff are preparing the sacrifice meat to be sold. Customers buy it for themselves, but they also purchase products to be donated to poor communities overseas. Hussam Danawi is the manager of Medina Halal Meats in Melbourne.
Our beloved Prophet Muhammad said that every household has to sacrifice one lamb, you know, and donate most of it to the poor, to make them feel special, to make them feel happy, and to feed them.
His customers can send their donations to 6 different countries.
If someone comes and purchases a lamb and decide to be distributed overseas, we send that lamb overseas, free of charge. Okay, we facilitate this service. And for example, as we speak, you know, there's about 500 lambs flying, you know, to Lebanon to be distributed on Wednesday, Thursday, to the many poor people and many, many Syrian refugees in Lebanon.
One of his customers is Dr. Mahabubur Mollah, who has lived in regional Victoria for over 30 years after leaving Bangladesh.
People in Bangladesh most probably do not eat meat any other time of the year except this Eid al-Adha occasion.
Each year, Dr. Mollah sends his donation of sacrifice meat to remote communities in his home country. And he knows many other Australian Muslims have been doing the same.
God has given us the ability to help them, so why not? Because welfare and the charity is something bring happiness in your heart. And I'm sure lots of people with Muslim background in this country doing the same.
While the amount of donated meat from Medina Halal Meats is relatively small, manager Hussam Danawi says there are bigger organisations sending thousands of sacrificed sheep and goats overseas.
There is. It's a big, big amount coming from Australia. And Australia has been known for foreign aid, you know, and everybody wants to get involved, you know, in making a difference.
As well as providing food for the poor, the festival provides economic stimulus.
It creates a bit of economy there, get people get a bit of work to do in order for them to slaughter and distribute, and the poor also get some meat to eat.
Despite the out-of-pocket expenses, Hussam Danawi from Medina Halal Meats says it's well worth it.
This is our contribution as well, you know, for the poor people. If we can, you know, put some money from our own pocket, we can make a change, we will be very happy, and that will be our profit. That will be our reward, to see a smile on some of these beautiful kids' faces.
Melbourne butcher Hussam Danawi, ending that report from Jess Davis. It's 12:15, and it's been more than 18 months since the last shipment, but Buru Energy is now back in business, once again exporting crude oil from the Kimberley. The company, which restarted its oil field near Broome earlier this year, loaded a tanker out of Wyndham on the weekend, bound for Papua New Guinea. Matt Brand went along to the Wyndham port to catch up with Buru's Sean Nagra.
How you doing? My name is Sean Nagra. I work for Buru Energy. I'm a development engineer with Buru. We're here at the Wyndham port doing our first loading of Ungani crude oil from our new tank, which is tank 10 at the Wyndham port. It's got a capacity of about 80,000 barrels, which is about 12 million litres. And we're going to be pumping about 65,000 barrels, which is about 10 million litres of crude, onto the Marlin Amitrine.
Yeah, tell us about the Marlin Amitrine, this massive vessel in front of us.
Okay, yeah, the Marlin Amitrine is a standard MR-sized tanker. It is 183 metres long, and it's got a capacity of about 30,000 cubic metres, which is about 188,000 barrels.
And that black pipe on the side that I can see, I presume that's where the crude oil is travelling through and into the ship, yeah?
That's correct. That's correct, Matt. Yep. So we're pumping crude oil from the tank through our new sort of pumping system, and it's going through at a rate of about 400 cubic metres an hour. So it'll take us about 24 hours to pump 65,000 barrels through into that vessel today.
And I don't think I've seen a bigger no smoking sign on a ship, but I presume that's pretty important when you're carting crude oil.
It is, yeah. Crude oil is an unrefined product, so basically it has some vapors associated with it. So you keep any naked flames and any sort of electrical switches or anything like that away from the source.
Yeah.
So we have this big no smoking sign.
Where's this ship off to?
It's actually going to Papua New Guinea.
Right.
So there's a refinery there where it'll take the crude and refine it into various products, and the products will go worldwide, depending on where the buyer decides to send it.
And what sort of products? Can you give us a sense of that?
Sure, yeah. Crude can be broken up into a number of different products. So it'll go through a refinery, and then you'll get, diesels, you'll get kerosenes, naphthas, you get tars for roads. It's a very valuable commodity, and we're very lucky to be able to produce it.
It's been a while between shipments. This is the first one since production restarted there on Yakamunga Station. What does it mean for the company to see shipping once again?
Look, it's really great for Buru. We shut in because of low oil prices, and now we've seen a sort of rise in the oil price back to $50 a barrel. We've also got bigger ships and bigger parcels of crude, so it's fantastic. It's really, really good opportunity for Buru, and we've got a lot of local contractors working for us, and so, yeah, it's been really, really good.
And so over the next 12 months, what can Wyndham expect in terms of shipping?
I think we'll probably see 6 more of these tankers coming in over the next 12 months, so one every 2 months. Obviously, we'd like to get the rate up, and we'll do our best to get more tankers in, but that's pretty much what we're aiming at for the next 12 months.
Sean Nagra is a development engineer for Buru Energy, speaking there with Matt Bran in Wyndham yesterday. And if you want to read a little bit more about that shipment and that story, is up online. So if you just search for ABC Rural, if you can spit it out, it's probably easier to type, and crude oil Wyndham, you'll be able to find that pretty easily in your search engine. And rising commodity prices are driving an increase in mining activity right throughout Australia. Since January, the price of copper has gone up 18% and gold is up 12%. There are several copper mines right across Australia and about 50 gold mines. Most of them are here in WA, but New South Wales, Victoria and Tasmania have 4 or 5 each. David Claughton takes a look at what appears to be renewed confidence in some sectors of the mining industry.
The March figures from the Australian Bureau of Statistics showed an increase in spending on minerals exploration of about 5%, with WA performing strongly. Growth in New South Wales is also up about 28% over the last 12 months. Exploration nationally is still well below the peak in 2012, but copper and gold is doing better than other sectors. Norwegian company Tomra does a lot of rock sorting for mines in Australia and says things are getting busy again in copper and gold mines.
We see the resurgence in the copper price and all the metals, polymetallic pricing has given us a real kick on in terms of test work and development. It's probably the busiest it's been in 4 to 5 years for us in our pipeline of projects that are happening. And probably I'd say at least 50% of our test work at the moment is coming from the copper and gold space.
So with the kick in the price for gold and copper, what does that mean in terms of the number of people that you're employing or looking to employ?
We've kept that fairly stable for the short term. We have a long sales cycle from inquiry to get machines in the field and running, but we're certainly looking at putting more service personnel on to handle that quick kick on in terms of business growth.
So when you employ people, what do they do?
We've got an interesting and sometimes a little eclectic group of people in our operation. We have a physicist, geophysicist, software engineers, electronic engineers, some pretty cluey and intelligent people. And then other guys working in customer service and back office functions as well.
John Williams is the National Product Manager at Aztec Australia. It's a Queensland company which supplies mines in Australia, New Zealand and Papua New Guinea. They've got over 50 people working in Mount Isa, the Cadia Valley in Western New South Wales and in WA. They were promoting an excavator arm at a mining conference in Sydney.
An excavator arm without the cabin on it. It's an arm, and at the end of that arm, we fix a hydraulic breaker, which, you know, hits the rock and pulverises it into smaller and smaller pieces.
So we're hearing that the price of copper and gold's improving in the last few months. Is that affecting your business?
Yeah, I think this year what we've seen is a lot of miners are now entering into, you know, larger project cycles. We've seen the Carrapateena project down in South Australia with Oz Minerals just get given the green light. We've seen a lot of those big miners starting to approach equipment suppliers like us with projects that they're interested in getting off the ground. These are probably, you know, projects that are still sort of 6 to 8, 9 months away from sort of being fully realised, but it's certainly, you know, we're getting a lot more activity in that space than we were last year.
And is the Australian dollar having an impact on your business at all? Is that getting 79 cents?
Yeah, look, we get the majority of our equipment from US-based suppliers. When that Australian dollar ticks up against the US, yeah, we see a lot more of the phone ringing. And
because it's cheaper then to buy American stuff.
Yeah? That's exactly right. What was effectively $1 yesterday becomes 80 cents the next day.
Paul Wifford is the National Business Manager for ContiTech. That's a division of the Continental Corporation, which is a tech-listed company with 250,000 employees globally. In Australia, they have a plant in Bayswater that manufactures conveyor belts.
We've definitely seen an upswing in demand in our conveyor belt plant down in Melbourne, which is obviously a downstream effect of the demand within the industry. We're seeing some really good movement on more technological products.
What sort of thing?
So just behind us, we've got our pipe belt conveyor system, some technology that we have developed. We've been supplying in Europe for quite a number of years.
It moves rock,
yeah,
but
in a tube.
Rather than a belt.
Exactly, so it's an enclosed system.
Paul Wifford says Continental spends as much on research as Google, and he's hoping the upswing in copper and gold continues. There are 180 people employed at the Melbourne conveyor belt plant who are no doubt hoping the same.
David Claughton with that report. And just briefly, in some further resources news today, the Association of Mining and Exploration Companies has welcomed a new tax deduction scheme announced by the Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull at the weekend. The Junior Mineral Exploration Tax Credit will replace the existing Exploration Development Incentive Scheme in an effort to boost exploration or help out in that resources sector. AMEC CEO Simon Bennison says it'll be quite different from the current system. He believes it will be an effective scheme.
It's more akin to the Canadian system, even though it's not a flow-through share. It means that an investor can pay take up an issue of new capital by a company, an exploration, Greenfields Exploration Company, and that company will, you know, following on from the exploration expenditure, will allow a 30% tax credit to flow back to the investor. And that investor can then claim that tax credit against their assessable income.
Simon Bennison from AMEC there about that new scheme for mining exploration. Coming up after the news at 12:30, we're going to take a look at diversification on the farm. And I'd love to hear your examples. If you've managed to diversify, if you're thinking about it, if it's something maybe you've done years ago, perhaps it went well, perhaps it didn't. Let me know on 0448 922 604. We'll be sharing stories of diversification on the farm all week this week. Some interesting examples. Speaking of, this could maybe fit into that category. It looks like Geraldton could be the perfect place to grow quinoa. Trials done by the Department of Primary Industries and Regional Development show the grain will grow well within irrigation or coastal conditions. Research Officer Richard Snowball is pretty excited about the results.
Oh, look, it's probably the best trial over the last 2 years we've had across the country, so it's really exciting. It's up at about neck height, so it's doing very well. It's a very good soil at that site. It's a very, very deep, a good loamy soil and very fertile. And they had a reasonable break, so there was quite good establishment of the quinoa at that site. So it's doing very well.
What are you hoping will come out of this research? Are you wanting to see quinoa in widespread cultivation in Western Australia?
That'd be great. I suspect that quinoa will end up being suited certainly to irrigated agriculture. But as far as the rain-fed situation is concerned, I think it'll end up being suited just to fairly small areas, probably coastal, just where there's a milder climate.
Richard Snowball speaking there with Lucinda Jose about quinoa trials in the Midwest of WA. So quinoa is quite a trendy crop at the moment. It's gluten-free, it's healthy, and it takes less time to cook than rice. I've actually got it in my lunch today. But you might not be much of a quinoa person, but perhaps you're a bit of a cheese lover. Well, artisan cheesemakers right around Australia are preparing for a surge in demand from both local and Asian customers. Compared to the rest of the world, the Australian cheese industry is pretty tiny, but it is highly regarded. And a recent government report found that the industry is well placed to capitalise on increasingly sophisticated consumer tastes around the world. Tyne Logan has this report.
So this is the white mould growth, which we get after about 10 days.
And cheesemaking has long been a labour of love for Western Australia's Alana Langworthy, and that passion is paying off. The Southwest cheesemaker says she can't keep up with demand.
You know, it's only been 2 years, and to be expanding to this sort of size, it's unexpected, really. So I'm very excited. We're at the stage where we need to expand probably 2 to 3 times what we're currently producing. So the plan is to build a new cheesery, hopefully within the year, so we can supply our shop that's based here. But we will have the production hopefully based over at our new property in the Yelling Up Hills. So at the moment we do about 1,000 litres worth of milk a week, so roughly translates to about 300 kilos of cheese. So we're looking to go up to probably 1,000 kilos of cheese a week. That's the grand plan.
That's a lot.
It's significant, yeah. So please buy lots of cheese.
Ms Langworthy is one of many producers who've noticed changing attitudes when it comes to specialty cheese. The artisan cheese industry prides itself on quality. Producers target consumers with a more sophisticated palate, which Ms Langworthy says there are more and more of in Australia and places like Singapore and Hong Kong.
Look, I think what we can do here is we can produce such amazing variation throughout. You know, it's a large state. There's so many small pockets of different microclimates, and that, like wine, translates to very different styles of cheese across the place. So what we produce here would look very different to what is produced on the East Coast. So I think they've got a taste for artisan product, and they're interested in stuff from not only WA but all over Australia, and I think we fit a niche being very close to Asia that they can, you know, pick up cheese here and take it back relatively easily.
A report by the Department of Primary Industries and Regional Development recently identified premium cheese as a key growth market for WA producers, with the potential to add millions to the state economy.
So the report really looked at a range of products that were showing upward trends both internationally and also within some key markets. And in the cheese space, particularly the artisan cheeses, we were seeing quite impressive growth rates in the UK, the USA, Canada and other key markets. It's anticipated that that kind of emerging trend around people moving to having more discerning tastes and moving to greater variety in their cheese consumption habits with the cafe culture, etc., will also replicate here. The consultants also identified a fairly significant potential export market for cheeses with some of our closer trading partners. So a total export market in the order of around $730 million.
While the report was centred around the West Australian industry, manager of the Deepherd Food Innovation Project, Kim Antonio, says the trends identified are happening all around the country. It's a point that's not gone unnoticed by other Australian cheesemakers. Chris Lloyd is a cheesemaker in South Australia and is also the director of Australia's largest cheese festival. She says in recent times there's been a massive influx of new producers entering the industry.
I think that just in the short little while, probably around 18 months, I would say that I know about, at least around a dozen new cheesemakers have popped up. And that's across all milks as well. So it's not just cow, it is cow, it's sheep, it's goat, and also buffalo more recently.
After years of dairy farming, Philip and Tavis Hall from Harvey in Western Australia's southwest are giving cheesemaking a go. Right now, they're preparing to release their first line of cheese.
For our business, I think it's very because the agriculture industry is always changing. So I think it's very important for us to diversify.
And as the entire industry grapples with the best way to respond to growing demand, the biggest challenge for producers is how to target the right markets and reach the scale required to service them.
Tyne Logan with that report. And there is more up online at abc.net.au/rural. You can check out a link to that story also up on our WA Country Hour Facebook page with a gorgeous video as well. Might make you a little bit hungry considering it's just before my lunchtime. That's some nice sliced up cheese there. It's 28 minutes to 1 o'clock. Rebecca Dollery joins me in the studio for news headlines.
Thanks, Bridget. Perth Lord Mayor Lisa Scafidi has been temporarily disqualified from office by the State Administrative Tribunal. In May, the tribunal found the Lord Mayor had breached the Local Government Act 45 times by failing to properly disclose gifts and travel worth tens of thousands of dollars. Today, the SAT ruled Ms Scafidi be disqualified from office for 18 months. The Premier Mark McGowan has ridiculed the WA Liberals' move to explore cutting financial ties with Canberra. At their state conference yesterday, the Liberals decided a committee should examine whether Western Australia could become financially independent in response to growing anger over the state's low share of GST revenue. And South Koreans have divided opinions on the best way to deal with North Korea. Some say the international community needs to sternly respond to Pyongyang's actions, while others argue military action could result in the destruction of both Koreas. South Korea's military today carried out a ballistic missile exercise in response to Pyongyang's latest nuclear test. Thanks, Bridget. More news at 1 o'clock.
Thank you so much. Rebecca Dollery there with the news headlines. Let's cross now to the Weather Bureau, where Rabi Rivette is there on the line. If I could just figure out which line you're on. There we go, Rabi. What can we expect across the Southwest Land Division?
Well, we've got some cloud over the southern parts of the Southwest Land Division at the moment. Some showers in southern parts, but they should be contracting to coastal parts, southern coastal parts by this evening. Those conditions kind of continue into Tuesday morning, but with the showers clearing during the morning, and then just lingering a little in the sort of Albany coastal area for Wednesday morning. We may see some showers and thunderstorms sort of developing from the north for everywhere sort of north of Durian Bay in the Southwest Land Division. And then on Wednesday. And then on Thursday, the weather extends just a smidgen further south, getting into the northern parts of the central wheat belt. At this stage, it's sort of mid-level activity with not a lot of rainfall associated with it, just a chance of a shower or thunderstorm. On Friday, the weather becomes a little bit less likely, but extends further south. So we see it sort of in the areas. There's a slight chance for the areas inland from the west coast, basically east of, say, Jury and Bay to Albany, and then it gets a little bit more likely a bit further east, and then that's contracting away after that.
And what can we expect, Ravi, for our northern and eastern districts?
Well, at the moment, it's pretty much sunny throughout in the north. The only real time we're going to get some weather starting to develop on Wednesday. So at first, in the far northwestern corner of the Gascoyne, and then extending southeast to western parts of the Gascoyne, far western parts of the Pilbara. That weather extends a bit further east and south on Thursday. Sort of as it goes into the Southwest Land Division, it gets into the southern Gascoyne, and then it starts easing during Friday.
Any warnings to speak of?
No warnings at the moment, although we are getting some reasonably fresh east-southeasterly winds, 20 to 25 knots offshore from the Pilbara coast in the mornings at the moment.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Ravi Rivette there with the Weather Bureau, and Richard Hudson joins me in the studio to read through the rainfall over the weekend.
Yeah, nothing worth reporting for the Kimberley, Pilbara regions, but for the Gascoyne, Steep Point had 6 mils. Nothing at all in the interior. In the Goldfields, not much. And in the Eucla, Red Rocks Point had 19 mils, which is pretty good. Nothing out on the islands. And then in the central west region, Barberton East had 5, Nambung Station 7. In the lower west region, Bickley 6, Bindoon 5, Bungendore 6, Chidlow 6 as well. Dwelling Up 7, Huntly the same, Carrigullen North 8, Lake Chittering 10, Lancelin 11, Millenden 7, Mount Helena 8, Mount Solis the same, Mundaring 8 as well, Pierce 6, in Perth at the airport 5 mils, Rolleystone 7 and Whiteman Park the same. And then in the southwest region, Bridgetown 6 mils, Donnybrook 5, Carrie Valley Research Station 11, Manjimup 11 as well, Mount William 6, Northcliffe 15, Pemberton 20, Shannon 13, Somme Creek 7, Walpole 14, Walpole Forestry 11, Warner Glen 5, Windy Harbour 11 and Wychcliffe had 6. And then in the southern coastal region, Albany 27, at the Albany Airport just 17, Aimalup 5, Barrett Meadows 28, Beaumont West 11, Bremer Bay 15, Shane Beach 21, Dalyup Park 5, Denbarker 14 over 4 days, Denmark 22, Erinair 18, Esperance 25, Esperance Airport 19, Gardiner 5, Hopetoun North 13, Kendanup 7, King River 12 over 4 days, Many Peaks 18, Metla 13, Mount Barker 12, Munglinup 17, Munglinup West 10, Narrakup West 16, Ongerup 5, Tamar 10, Tallina Downs 15, The Duke 19, Warrajarra 7 and Windrush 10. And then in the central wheat belt, Ballardew 5 and Wongan Hills had the same. And then in the Great Southern, Cranbrook 5, Desert Fringe 7, Dumbleyung 5. And that's it. Not too much in the Great Southern.
Thanks for that. Richard Hudson there with the rainfall over the weekend. It is 22 minutes to 1 o'clock here on the Country Hour.
The Country Hour on ABC Radio WA.
You're with me, Bridget Fitzgerald. It's great to be with you on this Monday afternoon. This week on the program, we're going to share some remarkable stories with you about diversification within agribusinesses, from a seafood operation in the north of the state to a winery in the south. We'll explore some of the ways that businesses have added an extra money-making element to their operations. If you've got an example that you'd like to share with us, very happy to hear it. 0448 922 604 is the number to text me on. 0448 922 604. Well, Robin Cousins and her husband Lindsay were operating a fairly standard grain and sheep farm at Watheroo. That was until they added pastured eggs into their mix in 2014. Pastured egg production is pretty much what it sounds like. The Cousins' chickens roam freely on a pasture paddock at a low stocking density. After starting with about 100 birds, the family now has 2,500 hens, and they can't keep up with demand for their eggs.
We're a broadacre farm and we have diversified into doing pastured egg production.
So we've got wheat, sheep and chickens all within the one property.
Yes. We started doing it in 2014 when we just had 100 little day-old chicks. and then it's slowly grown to 2,500. So we've probably been in proper production for the last year and a half to 2 years.
What are you aiming to get to?
About 3,500 to 4,000 hens. Yeah. Yeah.
Why did you decide to incorporate pastured eggs into your business?
Well, we've got four children and it got to the point where they sort of all left home and I was left wondering what more can I add to the farm. So we sort of had a bit of, I don't know, time to think, well, will I go off farm to work or will I, will we add something on to the existing farm? And I'm a bit passionate for food and love, you know, fresh produce and love all that movement, and thought Lindsay sort of said, let's do chooks. I wasn't actually all that keen to start with, but we got 100 chooks and then off we went. I think people are looking for something more paddock to plate. So our chooks are roaming freely on pasture. It's as holistic as we can get it, and we're honest with the consumer. So what they get is an honest egg.
Did you feel like when you were making those initial steps and that initial investment to begin pastured egg production that you were taking a risk, or were you confident that there wasn't?
Well, we've
there?
Gone, we're moving really, really slowly. So we've only ever met the demand as we've gone along. I mean, if it was going to be a risk, it would mean that we'd be getting like 10,000 chooks all at once. That would be the risk. But we're sort of going very slowly and just staying a little bit behind the eight ball, really, so that we could, we've got something to meet rather than us trying to catch up with what we need to meet. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah. You're producing roughly 2,500 eggs a day.
Yes.
How's demand for that, for them?
We can't keep up. It's, yeah, there's definitely room out there for more pastured egg growers.
Who's eating pastured eggs?
People. No, people that are passionate and feel strongly about the welfare of the animal, of the hen, and people that feel strongly about their health.
We're standing in a paddock that once had crop grown on it, but it's yep. currently pasture. There's chooks, as far as I can see, pretty much. They're just roaming around everywhere. How do the chooks integrate in with your cropping and your sheep production?
Well, this is their paddock for now. Like, this is a 50-hectare paddock. We usually crop this, but it's not a high-producing paddock. It's good enough to grow some rye and stuff for the chooks, so we'll keep these on here until they reach the end of the paddock, and then we will put them on another 50 hectares in another paddock that's probably not high-producing with crop. And, yeah, they just go in with the rotation of everything else.
The chickens are laying and live in sea containers, which you're moving up
yep.
the paddock.
Yep.
Once they've been through a paddock or through a section of a paddock, what do you notice in terms of the soil health and soil quality?
Yeah, well, if behind us there's a paddock that the original hens were in, and we've cropped that little tiny paddock this year. We didn't notice any change to start with, but since it's rained a little bit more, we can start to see where they've been, like clumps of quite green sections, which I can show you on the way out. Yeah, for sure, there's a definite difference in how they're improving the soil.
So what has pastured egg production meant for your business?
Well, from a business perspective, it's given us some cash flow. So in farming, we generally just get paid at the end of the year or after shearing or after we sell sheep or something like this or like that. Whereas the hens, we have to sell their eggs weekly or daily, basically. So we do, it's opened up for a bit of cash flow throughout the whole year. So that's been good for the business, yeah.
It must be profitable, though, the amount of time that you're putting into
yeah.
each and every one of these chooks.
Yeah, well, initially we thought it wouldn't be a lot of time, but it seems to be taking up a lot of time these days. But we're still in the phase of building sheds, so we build all our own sheds. Everything we do really is just about done by us. We're generating an income at the moment, but it's still going back into it because we're building the sheds. But absolutely, definitely, it will be a nice addition to the Broadacre farm. Absolutely.
That's Wallaroo grain and sheep and pastured egg producer Robin Cousins. And if you want to see what 2,500 chickens look like running around outside, there's a great video on our WA Country Hour Facebook page. Underneath that video that we've shared, Russell has posted a comment to say, perfect for those that like real free range. Kim says diversification is the way to go in today's wheat belt environment. And Natasha says, great video and story, but look at all those pig melons. Thanks for pointing that out there, Natasha. And tomorrow we're heading north because it turns out fruit juice and crabs have quite a bit in common. I'll just leave that with you and I'll explain more on tomorrow's program. And a seafood factory in Carnarvon is value adding to its business and they're looking at juicing local produce, honeydew, melons and mangoes. So more detail giving on that tomorrow. So head to our WA Country Hour Facebook page once again if you want to see that video from Robin's pastured hens running around. They're looking very happy indeed. It's 1:15. Some wheat belt farmers are concerned that if royalties for regions is scrapped, an ambitious plan to improve salinity might be in jeopardy. There's been much speculation about whether R4R will be continued under this new Labor government. And with the state budget to be handed down later in the week, the WA Nationals have launched a campaign warning that this royalties for regions program might be scrapped altogether, which could be bad news for the Wheatbelt Catchment Alliance, which is a group trying to get funding for 1,000 kilometres of drainage to fix salinity problems across WA's agricultural region. Beacon farmer John Dunn is an Alliance member and he thinks this is a serious problem that needs attention.
Over the cleared area of land in the Wheatbelt, an estimated 4.3 million hectares of the southwest region has a high potential of developing salinity from shallow water tables, and this is predicted to rise to approximately 8.8 to 9 million hectares by the year 2050. Neither governments, whether it be Liberal, Labor or whoever, nor NRM groups currently have got a plan for saltland recovery in the Wheatbelt. But the Wheatbelt Catchment Alliance, which has been developed over a number of years, and I think it was about 2006 we were incorporated. We developed a plan which we refer to as our business case for developing arterial deep drainage throughout the Wheatbelt. And we predict that we can prevent the further spread of salinity throughout the Wheatbelt. And we believe we can reclaim up to 75% of the land which has already been lost.
So is there concern that that increase in salinity will actually render that land unproductive and unusable?
It certainly is predicted that way. There's a lot of land already completely unproductive. And in places where some of our drains have been established, we're already growing wheat and barley and other crops right alongside the drains, particularly up in the area up around Killarney, Perenjori, Murrawa, all the way up to Carnamar. In those areas, within a couple of years of putting in drainage, we're able to grow substantial crops.
So what kind of drainage system exists already to try and tackle that salinity problem?
There's very little drainage which is linked together, which is properly managed. In the Wheatbelt, the drainage lines, because of our high evaporation rate, we don't have rivers that run continuously like they do close to the coast. So we've got a discontinuous drainage line. And really what's happening is water is running from the higher parts of the landscape into the lower parts of the landscape, carrying the salts into the lower parts of the landscape. And then the water evaporates, leaving the salts behind. And there's no way for that land to do anything but deteriorate further.
Are you concerned at all that the WA Nationals Party, they've actually launched an advertising campaign because they are worried that the royalties for regions might not be made available at all and it might in fact go into budget repair?
From what I hear on the radio and read in the newspapers, it is part of Labor's plan to reallocate a lot of royalties for regions funding to other purposes. We want to try and persuade them that this project is worthy of them having a very close look at, and they can see the benefit that there's going to be there for the future of infrastructure and the agricultural areas throughout the state. If we can stop the extent or the encroachment of salinity, it'll protect roads, railway lines and other infrastructure, and they won't continue to deteriorate as they are.
If the government can't guarantee any funding, if there's nothing allocated in this budget, what's your next option?
If they don't support this project in this year's budget, then we will continue to look for funding wherever we can find it. But unfortunately, the federal government doesn't have a salinity policy. The state government doesn't seem to have any alternative plan than the type of thing that we're proposing. So we're hoping that they will fund this $4 million in this first year of the project. We've already expended about $120,000 has gone into a review of inland drainage under the previous government. So we've already done that as the first phase of the first year of this project.
But you do need to secure state government funding for it to go ahead.
We certainly do. We certainly do. We're a not-for-profit organisation. All of our members are volunteers, and there's an enormous amount of legwork has already been done to develop this business case.
John Dunn is a member of the Wheatbelt Catchment Alliance, and he's also a farmer at Beacon. And on the text line, Matt has said on 0448 922 604, to all the Liberal National voters having a crack at Labor, just remember who got us into this mess. There needs to be an investigation as to where and why the money was spent where it was. Matt has mentioned a $3.5 million on a pavilion in Tambalup and asks why, what sport gets played in Tambalup to warrant that level of public money. Matt says hopefully R4R gets spent where it's needed, on projects where it's needed. Thanks for that comment there, Matt. But just staying where in that region where John is from, who we just heard from, the big news for Beacon at the weekend was that the Beacon's men's shed has managed to get a 1948 Minneapolis mow line up and running, and it held pride of place at the Back to Beacon tractor parade over the weekend. Bruce Ingleton is the main mechanic at the Beacon shed. Bruce, what a great effort in getting that machine up and running. You must be pretty proud.
Just a little. Yes, it was quite a challenging project. The engine had been open to the weather for quite some years, and a couple of the pistons were very badly rusted in, and it took about a fortnight to soaking them and tapping them and so forth, just to jar them free, to get them out. Once we got them out, it was pretty straightforward getting it all back together.
Bruce, Richard Hudson, he was in Beacon at the start of July, and he's said to us that it looked just kind of like a wreck. In fact, we've shared a photo up on our Facebook page so people can get an idea of what it did look like. Was it tough to get some of those parts off? Some of those parts for it?
Oh, yes, it was very hard to get them off, but if you use a bit of gentle perseverance, it's... it took about a fortnight to free up one of those pistons that was the worst rusted in, but the rest of it was pretty straightforward. All the piston rings were seized in the grooves, and rather than break them and to free them up, I used some penetrating oil that's made by our own recipe. Actually, it was a recipe that was made by a member of the Track Mac Association.
A recipe for your own oil. That's very impressive. And you must have, we've actually seen a photo as well of people might remember, Bruce, of your hands all covered in oil. Maybe it's that homemade recipe oil from when we visited Beacon a couple of months ago. And so you've obviously done up a lot of tractors in your time. Are you most proud of this one?
Oh, I think equally as proud of this one. Some of the others have been terribly derelict and the engines have been in a very, very sad state, but it's just a matter of patience and perseverance, really.
Well, 2 weeks to get one part off. You must be a very patient man there, Bruce.
Oh, yes. Well, being an ex-farmer, you learn to be a bit patient.
A nice bit of advice. Thank you for that, Bruce, and well done. And we will have to see if anyone else actually has a photo of that new version of the 1948 Minneapolis mow line to please share it with us. Thanks so much, Bruce.
Okay, thank you so much.
Bruce Ingleton is the main mechanic at the Beacon Men's Shed. If you were at that event on the weekend and you've actually got a photo of Bruce's done-up Minneapolis mow line, please send it through to us on 0448 922 604 or share it with us on our Facebook page. We'd love to see it there as well.
Join us for The World Today.
Hello, I'm Eleanor Hall. On the program today, pressure growing on China to rein in the North Korean regime as the United States warns of a massive military response to the latest nuclear test. And the dangers of having our technology designed mainly by white men.
When Apple released their most recent smartwatch, they had an SDK, so a software developer kit, for how you could build things for that watch. And, you know, it's a lot of things that are about tracking your body and your health. And yet that SDK did not have anything for tracking menstruation.
No women involved in that one.
That's exactly right, and it was described as a niche usage.
More than the headlines, The World Today.
That coming up for you just after the news at 1 o'clock. Right now, though, let's cross to Mushe. Numbers were down actually this week. Cattle numbers down at the Mushe sale today. There was a total yarding of 1,171 cattle. It was dominated by the pastoral animals. John Testro is there. Hello, John.
Yeah, good afternoon, Bridget.
Run us through the details, please. Sorry, John, I forgot to ask you a question.
Yeah, not a problem, Bridget. But as you said, the market was, numbers were down by 700 head. To summarise, growing cattle remained firm throughout, however, the lightweight pastorals changed. Heifers were up 30 cents and steers down 15 cents, both quality driven. For some quotations, lightweight Vela steers, the feeders, there are very few offered. They sold from 252 to 358 cents, with the heifers at 280 cents, both generally firm. Yearling steers, local, were mainly 400 kilos plus and sold from 250 to 326 cents to remain firm. Feeders paid from 250 to 312 for the lighter weights. A better offering of heavy pastoral steers remained firm at 240 to 256 cents for the heavier, better bred types. Lightweight pastoral yearlings, as I said before, they ease 15 cents on quality at 140 to 252 cents. Yearling heifers, local and grain assisted, were over 400 kilos and they sold from 190 to 330 cents to remain firm. Pastoral heifers, again, the bulk of the yarding, rose 30 cents on the lightweights at 90 to 144 cents. This was due to a little bit of extra competition and quality. Medium weights at 118 to 290 cents, mainly to feeders. Heavy as 330 kilos plus remain firm at 140 to 170 cents. Grown steers were all pastoral today and they sold from 210 to 264 cents for the under 700 kilos live weight. Bullocks were over 700. They sold from 180 to 196 cents, again firm. There were nil-grown heifers penned at all. Cows were generally firm with best prime at 150 to 220 cents, score two medium weights at 130 to 152 cents, and the lightweight defeaters these 10 cents at 68 to 108 cents, again quality driven. Bulls again received strong live export competition, but they were generally firm with lightweights at 270 to 348 cents, mediums at 180 to 206 cents, and heavies to processors at 140 to 170 cents. This has been John Testrow at Mushe for the ABC and MLA's National Livestock Reporting Service.
Thanks so much for that, John. John Testrow there at Miche for us.
Most Australian farmers would be hard-pressed to remember a time without ABC Rural.
Voice of the Bush, a new book looking at the remarkable history of the ABC's Rural Department by historian Rob Lynn.
ABC Rural is the oldest continual agricultural broadcasting service anywhere in the world. I really think you're a mob of heroes.
Based on oral histories with ABC staff working on iconic programs like The Country Hour, A Big Country and Landline.
It's probably one of my favourite parts of the day, actually.
Available now from ABC Shops Online.
So, as I said, the rest of the week we're going to take a close look at different types of diversification on the farm. Make sure you listen in every day. We'll give you a new and different story. Might make you get thinking about the way you do things at your place. News time now, it's 1 o'clock.